This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me and my terrific producer, Calvin, this afternoon for the next 2 hours. My name is Jim Santel, and I am sitting in for Maggie, who is away doing other business, important business today. I'm going to be your host on the Maggie Dawn Show, both this hour and next hour, sitting in for Maggie, talking about many of the same issues animated her and you as well in recent days. Let me tell you a little bit about our plan for this hour and next hour as well. It includes you, of course, as it always does, and that includes your inquiries, your questions, your comments, your perspectives coming in here to the broadcast stations of Civic Media. That phone number is 855-752-4842. The easy way, Calvin reminds me, to remember that is 855-75-CIVIC. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Soliciting, as always, your questions, your inquiries, your comments. And Calvin also reminds me routinely that you can also drop those into the Civic Media app and be in touch with us in that way as well. Delighted, as always, to have you being a part of our discussion that includes many timely things this afternoon, including the fact that we gather here in America, in places throughout our nation, cities, villages, towns, counties, states, our nation as a whole, celebrating, observing Veterans Day, and we're going to spend a good deal of time in the first segments of our first hour here on the Maggie Dawn Show talking about Veterans Day, the history of it, why it's meaningful, and offering a couple of personal insights into my own connection with veterans who are so important not only to the present life and livelihood of the United States of America, but also have given us life and livelihood throughout the 248 years of our history. We'll talk about the history of Veterans Day and why it's meaningful to us as it is this year, every single year. Then we're going to go back into some of the relevant news of the recent days. When I was on Maggie's show just last Thursday, we talked about the status of these four criminal cases, yes, still pending as of now, against Donald Trump, recently elected by the people of America to serve as the next president of the United States of America. What's the status of those? Maggie and I began to talk about those on Thursday of last week. A couple of amendments, a couple of additions, not changes in our reporting, but things that supplement that reporting from just last Thursday, things that have happened in the wake of our discussion about those four cases, two of them state premised, two of them federally premised. We'll chat about where all those cases are, some things that happened late last week, something that's going to happen tomorrow in one of those cases that also prompts all of us to be attentive to the news and specifically to jurisprudence in America. We're going to talk about those cases as well and then move on into some other news stories in the areas of law and regulation and courts and the administration of justice that have been happening even as we continue to think about, ponder the results of the election of 6 days ago, electing Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States of America, other things going on in other courts, in other tribunals, in other ways that are also going to affect not only the days just ahead, but frankly, the coming administration as well. In many ways, tendrils emanating from these various news events. We're going to talk about six or seven of those that have also been going on that animate the news here in America and beyond. All of that here on the Maggie Dawn Show. My name once again, Jim Santel, sitting in, delighted, honored to sit in on behalf of Maggie today, but also continuing her wonderful tradition of inviting your participation in our broadcast this afternoon, this hour, and also next hour. Let us begin this hour with a recognition and observance of Veterans Day. It is November 11th, 2024. It was originally known, as all of you know, I suspect, as Armistice Day. We honor today the military veterans of all of our United States Armed Forces. Indeed, President and the Vice President doing just that, the first time that they appeared in public just earlier today in Washington, D.C., recognizing again these tremendous contributions that veterans, both living and dead, have made to the safety and security of our nation, a nation that we continue to abide by in terms of the fundamental truths for which they fought, for which they continue to serve on our behalf to this day. Coincides with other holidays, including Armistice Day, Remembrance Day, commemorated in other countries, also marking the end, basically, of World War I. Let's talk about where Veterans Day comes from. On November 11th of 1919, President Woodrow Wilson issued a major message, a major communication to the people of our nation. On the first Armistice Day, he wrote this. He said, he expressed what he felt about what the day means to Americans, should mean continuing to us to this day. He said, a year ago today, our enemies laid down their arms in accordance with an armistice which rendered them impotent to renew hostilities and gave to the world an assured opportunity to reconstruct its shattered order and to work out in peace a new and more just set of international alliances. Those alliances that fought and endured for more civilization against the aggression of armed forces, something that happened again a year earlier. Woodrow Wilson went on to talk about the splendid forgetfulness of mere personal focus when sometimes we focus on financial resources or the significant things that animate our lives personally and, in fact, overlook from time to time the importance of recognizing where all those come from, how they're premised upon a nation that is safe and secure based upon the things that our veterans have done. To us in America, he said, the reflection of Armistice Day are all important. We recognize, he said, the heroism of those who died in the country's service and who continue to live to this day to tell the stories of those excursions, those defenses on behalf of our nations, free nations in the world, including the United States of America. That was Woodrow Wilson on 1919, one year after the establishment of the first so-called Armistice Day. Of course, it recognizes the cessation, the formal cessation of hostilities in the immediate aftermath of World War I, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. Recognized by President Woodrow Wilson at that time, the United States Congress adopted a resolution then in 1926, June 4th of 1926, requesting that President Calvin Coolidge issue annual proclamations calling for the observance of November 11th with appropriate ceremonies. The Congress did that, calling upon the president to issue those proclamations, which presidents have done ever since then. A congressional act was approved on May 13th of 1938, making November 11th in each year a legal holiday, a day the observance was going to, did in fact, and was going to be forthwith a day dedicated to the cause of world peace and to be thereafter celebrated and known as Armistice Day. That was in 1938. In 1945, World War II veteran Raymond Weeks, W-E-E-K-S, from Birmingham, Alabama, had this terrific idea to expand Armistice Day to celebrate all veterans and not just those who died in World War I. Weeks led a delegation to General Dwight Eisenhower, who supported the idea of a National Veterans Day at that time. And Weeks led that first national celebration in 1947 in Alabama, his home state, and annually until his death in 1985. President Reagan, in fact, honored Weeks at the White House with a Presidential Citizenship Medal in 1982 and made that the driving force of that observance in that year. Elizabeth Dole, who prepared the briefing for President Reagan at the time, said that Weeks was the father of Veterans Day. A U.S. representative, his name is Ed Reese, from Emporia, Kansas, presented a bill establishing the holiday through Congress. President Dwight Eisenhower, also from Kansas, as you know, signed that bill into law on May 26 of 1954. It had been 8.5 years since Weeks held his first Armistice Day celebration for all veterans. Congress amended that bill on June 1 of 1954, replacing the word armistice with veterans, and it has been known as Veterans Day ever since that time. Significantly, there's a National Veterans Award created in 1954. Reese received the first National Veterans Award in Birmingham, Alabama. And of course, we continue to observe the important contributions that veterans, living and dead, have made to the safety, the security, the very breadth, the fabric, the geography of our nation ever since. Veterans Day 2024, a time when we think once again about those significant sacrifices, the continuing contributions that veterans of all varieties make to our life and our livelihood, including those in public service, many of those in the United States Congress, in the Senate and the Assembly houses around our states, in various county positions, in state positions, in municipal and town and village positions, all of those continuing their public service, many others now in private service, likewise continuing their support of this institution, this grand experiment we call the United States of America. We celebrate what they have done, what they will do going forward on this Veterans Day of 2024. We also gather today on Veterans Day to recognize that because of what they did, we continue to live to this day in a world, in a country, 50 states and territories around the planet, where courts and justice is meted out, where presidents engage in behaviors of various kinds that result in executive orders to make our country better. And we're going to spend some time in the next segments talking about some of those recent activities in the courts and beyond on this Veterans Day of 2024 here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
This is The Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie on this November 11th. It is Veterans Day, as we are observing here at Civic Media throughout the broadcast stations in Wisconsin and beyond. A point of personal privilege here as well to recognize the ways in which I have benefited from and reveled in the presence of veterans in my own life. When I was growing up, my father, who is himself a veteran of World War II, brought me on a routine basis to the grounds of the VA hospital, the grounds at Wood, Wisconsin, the now the Clement J. Zablocki Hospital in West Allis, Wisconsin, West Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was, for many of the professional years of his career, one of the assistant hospital administrators there. And so I grew up in many ways thinking a lot about the role that veterans play, not only at the Veterans Hospital there, which continues to be one of the major veterans hospitals of the Department of Veterans Affairs nationwide, but also a place where we have recognized on Memorial Day And also on Veterans Day, those veterans who have lost their lives in service to America and other nations around the world. Growing up in that place, visiting my father at the VA hospital on those grounds, for the ceremonies, for the events that recognize the important role that veterans play in our national experience, impressed upon me the significance of not only Veterans Day, but the continuing every single day contributions that veterans make, and the obligation, of course, represented by that hospital and the other tremendous services that continue to be provided to this day by the Department of Veterans Affairs. The importance of recognizing and continuing to support our veterans, an early investment in me and my sensitivity to the role of veterans in our history and our contemporary lives. Reminded as well when I was an assistant U.S. attorney and then also the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, greatly honored to represent the Department of Veterans Affairs in the federal courts, principally of Eastern Wisconsin, but beyond as well, principally in civil litigation, but also representing individuals in that setting who may have been involved in litigation of various kinds, being so proud to stand up in the courts of our federal tribunals and represent not only that I'm there for the United States of America, but representing the Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, this connection to veterans. And finally, during the 2 years that I spent as a civilian working with the Emerging Republic of Iraq, 2006-2008, during the war of that time, working with prisons and law enforcement, corrections officials and police officers, and most importantly, courts and judicial officers there in Baghdad, other places in the north to the south of the Iraqi nation, I was kept alive. I was kept quite literally alive by soldiers there, principally in the Army, but in all of the armed services. As we traveled from the international zone into Baghdad and into other cities to the north and to the south, my safety and security was safeguarded by people who were soldiers there for all of our military services, many of them now veterans of those, but a connection to me, once again, that I think about when we observe, as we do today, Veterans Day 2024, from my young history with my father at the VA hospital, from the time that I represented the Department of Veterans Affairs in the federal courts, and then to the time that I was serving as the rule of law coordinator and the justice attaché in Baghdad in the international zone, there at our embassy in Iraq, the important role that veterans then and now continue to play in my life. We recognize them once again here on Civic Media stations throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond for those great contributions. And we recognize the fact, of course, as we always say, that it's because of what veterans have done that we are still able to revel in a nation and in a government that can have as its principal purpose the point of taking care of all of us. That's in our Constitution, the Take Care Clause, a commission to the president, certainly, but also to the Congress, to courts. That's the role. That's the service role that veterans play. That's the service role that government should and must play as well, regardless of the administration. That's the role that government should play, and that's what veterans have fought for. That's why their service is so very important. Among the things, of course, that presidents do is they have the specific obligation under the second article of the Constitution to do all kinds of things, a great variety of things, both domestically and, of course, in the Foreign Service. All of that as a part of the president's role as commander-in-chief, but also responsible for domestic affairs. Among the things that cross both areas, both domestic matters but also international matters, are attempts by a president and, yes, by the Congress as well, to address what is undeniably a major immigration challenge that we have in this nation. Came close, not to resolving it completely, but to addressing it in major ways when a consortium of Republicans and Democrats in this Congress came together earlier this year and put together a piece of legislation that had all the votes for it in the United States Congress, the Senate, and the House, and then it failed. And because of the direction given by his own words to the members, the leadership, and those not in leadership in the Congress to not go ahead with that. We continue to wrestle with immigration issues to this day. That direction coming out from then private citizen, soon to be President Donald Trump. Along the way, many presidents, including Donald Trump in his first term, including Barack Obama, including presidents who have preceded him, and also the present president, Joe Biden, has attempted to wrestle with the immigration issue by issuing what are called executive orders. And indeed, the president of the United States of America, Joe Biden, issued not so long ago a significant executive order. It's known as the Keeping Families Together. He issued that executive order just in August of this past year. We've talked a lot about it here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. It would allow undocumented immigrants who are married to United States citizens and have been in this country, in the United States, for 10 years or more, a chance to gain a green card without leaving the country. All of that a part of this initiative. We're going to talk more about what the president attempted to do and what happened just this past week in connection with this issue about undocumented spouses and immigration in America here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on Veterans Day 2024. My name is Jim Santel. I'm sitting in for Maggie today, both this hour and the next hour today, as we not only observe Veterans Day 2024, but also talk about those news stories in our lives that are made possible and that are in many ways animated by the conduct, the behavior, the service of veterans for well over 200 years in American history. We always invite your comments, your questions, your inquiries into our discussion. That number is 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. And my terrific producer, Calvin, and I will be delighted to entertain your thoughts, your comments on any of these issues, beginning with this important news coming out of a federal court just this past week, having to do with this program put in place through an executive order by the current president. His name is Joe Biden. And back in August, he implemented this program called the Keeping Families Together Initiative. Again, an executive order not legislatively done, not done through the judiciary, which is the point of this particular news story. But generally, immigrants who've entered the United States illegally have to leave the country, have to depart, and then come back to complete the green card process. That can take years. The Biden program, which was in place for a whopping week before something happened last week in a federal district court, allowed for those who are married, again, married to United States citizens, to remain in the country. They didn't have to leave and come back. It granted them what the immigration system refers to as a thing called parole, P-A-R-O-L-E. It sets a status that also protects them from deportation, so keeps them here while their process goes forward. And at the time, President Biden at the time of his announcement of this initiative hailed that effort. He said it's a way to keep families together and offer them the comfort of knowing that they would avoid deportation, not dividing spouses, partners, husbands, wives, all kinds of people who are benefiting, should benefit, from not only the largesse, the wonders of our nation, but also an immigration system that should treat them fairly. That's what his message was. He said, these couples have been raising families, sending their kids to church and school, paying taxes, contributing to our country. Said they're living in the United States all this time with fear and uncertainty. We can fix that. And that's the reason why he issued this executive order. Again, not legislative. Not through the courts. He said, I'm going to do this by a stroke of a pen, by virtue of my authority as the President of the United States of America. Last Thursday, a federal judge in Texas struck down that administration program that sought to provide this path for U.S. citizenship for quite literally hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who happen to be married to American citizens. The ruling was issued by a judge named J. Campbell Barker, B-A-R-K-E-R. He's in the United States District Court. This is a federal court for the Eastern District of Texas, one of the 93 districts in America. It comes quite literally months after an initiative, litigation initiative, that was spearheaded in many ways by Ken Paxton. Who is that? You know him as the Attorney General for the state of Texas. He files this lawsuit claiming that the administration lacked the authority. President Biden does not have the authority, he said, to enact this program. Only the Congress can do it. And in August, in the wake of the start of that lawsuit, Judge Barker, the federal judge, temporarily blocked all of this just about a week after it had already gone into effect. On Thursday, the judge issued a 74-page decision, 74 pages. He said that the Biden administration did not, in fact, have the authority to create the program. Presidents cannot do this, he said. Only the Congress can do it. And for that reason, the program stricken down by the federal district court judge there in eastern Texas. The result of that, of course, is that the program now not only is stricken down, but will be the subject of an appeal. The United States Department of Justice indicating that even in this Department of Justice, an effort made to appeal that decision. Where does that go? That goes to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, challenging the decision by J. Campbell Barker to strike it down and attempting to restore it in much the same way that other executive orders in this area were called DACA, well, issued by President Obama. Another attempt to address the thorny, difficult challenges that are presented by an immigration system that is undeniably broken with a small b, and significantly the Congress, again, has not wrestled with. And that's the problem. We've got a situation where presidents feel compelled to, and I'd offer, should act when the Congress does not, to address major problems like these. I mentioned before that the United States Congress, this Congress, the 118th Congress, was on the verge of enacting some major legislation that would have solved not every problem, not overnight, but would have accomplished much of what we need to address, not only in the Southwest border, but basically in these kinds of things. How do we deal with all kinds of young people? Middle-aged people, old people who are here and whose situations have prompted them to fall through the cracks of a system that doesn't address their particular challenges. Well, Congress was about to do that. Donald Trump instructed the Republican leadership in the Congress not to go ahead with it, and it sank. Even after there was a unanimous result, a unanimous agreement among the members of Congress that this should go ahead, a bipartisan movement to get that done. Well, again, presidents, in the absence of action by the United States Congress, quite literally now for decades, to address an issue of immigration, attempting very strongly, very, very aggressively, if you will, to issue executive orders to address things that the Congress has not. Just this past week, J. Campbell Barker of the U.S. District Court in the Eastern District of Texas says, you can't do that, Mr. President. And so we'll see what the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals does. Another significant thing, of course, is Department of Justice is going to change leadership in about 70 days from now. We'll see if that initiative to take that case up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, if that continues, highly likely it won't. Time running out for this particular initiative, the Keeping Families Together executive order announced by President Biden back in August almost certainly now a casualty, both of a decision by this federal district court judge who says you can't do this beyond the authority, and also by the election of just about 6 days ago, in which a new administration will come in and change the priorities and change the positions of the Department of Justice in courts, district courts, appellate courts, the Supreme Court around the country. We've got another decision just this past week, this one by a military judge appropriate on this Veterans Day. A military judge ruled just last week that those plea agreements, remember those plea agreements between the alleged 9/11 co-conspirators? They've been at Guantanamo Bay virtually since the time that they were apprehended in the wake of 9/11, identified as the masterminds and the people who put that in place, who are the architects of the attack upon our nation. Those plea agreements put together between those defendants who have been sitting there in prison and the U.S. government. The military judge saying that those agreements are valid and enforceable. What were those agreements? The agreements basically said that the defendants could, in fact, agree to remain in prison for the rest of their natural lives, but it took the death penalty off the table. The government would agree not to pursue the death penalty as to them if they plead guilty to a number of criminal offenses and agree also to remain in prison, of course, for the rest of their lives, death penalty being taken off the table. What happened, of course, is that the defense secretary, Austin, you may recall well, determined that that particular agreement entered into by military attorneys and counsel for those defendants not properly going ahead. And so the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, said, I'm recalling that. I'm saying that that cannot happen. And what happened just last week reverses the decision of the defense secretary. The ruling now allows for the plea deals to go forward and could mean that these defendants will eventually be sentenced to life in prison and therefore avoid death sentences, which is what the original plea agreements called for. The judge, his name is Colonel Matthew McCall, M-C, capital C-A-L-L. He is not a federal district court judge. He's a military judge. He said last week at the start of a pretrial hearing that he expected that the accused would be able to submit their guilty pleas as early as this week, November 14th or 15th, following the conclusion of witness testimony on another matter. And that will largely entail McCall, discussing the allegations with the defendants to ensure that they know what they're doing, that they're clear about what they are pleading to and are doing so willingly. All of that announced by the military judge, reversing the decision by the defense secretary just this past week that invalidated those plea agreements, now likely going ahead this week in those military tribunals there, after the judge takes care of some other matters, going to engage in what's called a colloquy with these defendants, asking them if they understand what they're doing, asking them if they appreciate the fact that they will never see the light of day. They will be in prison for the rest of their natural lives. And the exchange with the government, with the military, is that the government will not seek their death, will not seek to execute them in exchange for their agreement to plead guilty and then to remain in prison for the rest of their lives. Needless to say, a highly controversial matter at the time that the plea agreements were initially announced. Huge amount of controversy. Some of the families of the victims of 9/11 objecting, voicing their opinions to the defense secretary, telling him how inappropriate and significant in terms of not accomplishing justice these plea agreements were. They were plainly seeking the death penalty as to all of these defendants. A military judge now overruling the defense secretary, saying no, the defendants and the government and the military can in fact go ahead with those. That will keep them in prison and also resolve, after quite literally decades of non-resolution, what we do with these individuals who've been sitting in Guantanamo Bay without clear resolutions to their case. Great challenges also prompting these plea agreements in bringing their case, what, into a federal district court, into a military court, trying to try those cases in the midst of great numbers of national security secrets that make those cases difficult. And so all of this, an attempt by the United States military to bring at least this chapter of 9/11, which will never go away. The book never closed on 9/11, of course, in the history of our nation. But this chapter about what we do with these people who we know were the architects of that, what do we do to bring their cases to resolution? The conflict, the disagreement, the objection to this will continue probably for as long as we continue to address issues related to 9/11. But this past week, a military judge saying go ahead with the plea agreements. He will take those agreements. He will enter them this coming week in the days ahead. And that will then resolve those cases long pending for those defendants sitting there in Guantanamo Bay. That's a military judge, not a federal judge, but nonetheless, he has the authority to act in that area because of the fact that these are military charges against these defendants. We do have federal judges, again, like the one in Eastern Texas that ruled unconstitutional Joe Biden's petition, his position, his articulation of this executive order that would keep some undocumented spouses in the country, that now being overruled by invalidated by this judge. That's a federal district court judge. There's another federal district court judge, Illinois, that did something very significant also just late last week. Federal judge in Illinois has ruled that Illinois' blanket ban on assault weapons, you may recall this well, we've talked a lot about this story, blanket ban on assault weapons there in Illinois is unconstitutional. Violates, the judge said, the Second Amendment to the Constitution, specifically invoking that case called Bruin, that case involving the need to support or not support any legislation that restricts, controls, somehow affects the status and the transfer, the possession of firearms in America. Can only do it, the Supreme Court said, if you look back in history, if you can find in tradition and in history a basis for doing it. Well, Stephen McGlynn, who's a U.S. District Court judge for the Southern District of Illinois, using that Bruin position, that Bruin articulation, finding that the ban in Illinois against assault weapons is unconstitutional. We'll talk more about exactly what Judge McGlynn did just this past week when the Maggie Dawn Show continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, surveying some significant things that have happened in the past week in the wake of the election of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States of America. Our courts, our military courts, continue to act in ways big and small on various things that affect our lives here in America. Commenting now upon the action by Stephen Glynn. He's a U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of Illinois, finding just this past week that the previous ban implemented by the legislature of the state of Illinois, signed by the governor there, that prohibits assault weapons, prohibiting assault weapons to keep us all safe and secure, at least in the state of Illinois, that's unconstitutional. He says, why? Because you haven't identified an historical precedent, something in the past that justifies in 2023, 2024, you're imposing this kind of restriction on the Second Amendment right. That's what he says, Steve McGlynn. He, of course, does this in the wake of the 2023 passage by the legislature of something called the Protect Illinois Communities Act. It banned those high-powered assault weapons that we've seen in so many of the mass shootings in America. Also, large capacity magazines, likewise, that compromise our safety and security, as well as the sale, the manufacture, the delivery, and purchase of assault weapons across the entire state. You can't do that in Illinois, said the legislature. The law, of course, was created, you all recall, after that mass shooting in Highland Park during that Independence Parade in July of 2022, drawing some national attention. And in November of 2023, a federal appeals court in Illinois upheld the ban, saying even the most important personal freedoms have their limits. Well, Judge McGlynn has disagreed with that now in the federal system. He says so much about firearms is contentious. Yes, it is, Judge McGlynn. He says from the political debate to the jurisprudential debate, and then she launches into his position. He says at the crossroads of this debate stands the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. He says despite those who value weapons of war more than public safety, this law was enacted to and has protected Illinoisans constant fear of being gunned down in places where they ought to feel secure. That actually a spokesman for the governor's office responding to what has happened here and announcing, of course, their likely appeal of the judge's decision to a higher court. So we look forward to the attorney general pursuing an immediate appeal and the governor confident that the constitutionality of the Protect Illinois Communities Act will be sustained. But of course, the judge himself, that's the ruling that remains in place as of this day. Judge McGlynn sided with the plaintiff, sided with people who are contrary to that position. He said that the law criminalizes the knowing possession of hundreds of previously lawful rifles, handguns, and shotguns. That's what the judge himself wrote. He said what is particularly disturbing is that the prohibition of weapons that are commonly owned and used by citizens are now banned. Yes, indeed they are, Judge, because they present a real and present danger to our safety and security. Judge McGlynn went on to say this: they deprive citizens of a principal means to defend themselves and their property in situations where a handgun or a shotgun alone would not be the citizen's preferred arm. Sadly, he said, there are those who seek to usher in a sort of post-Constitution era where the citizen's individual right are only as important as they are convenient to a ruling class. Stunning language coming out of a federal district court judge, but using what our Supreme Court has said in that Bruin case of a couple of years ago, saying you can't support a restriction or limitation on firearms unless you find an historical antecedent for it. The judge now finding that the governor's position, that the legislator's position on all this, banning these assault weapons, that yes, indeed, our weapons of war have no place in our domestic environment, not in the streets and not in the homes, not in the businesses and the public places of America. In Illinois, attempt to stop the tumult, the catastrophe that's brought on by these weapons, in place for a long time, until Judge McGlynn just this past week says no. You got to permit, under the Second Amendment, anyone to hold and possess and use, presumably, an assault weapon in America. And if you don't do that, you're running afoul of the Constitution of the United States of America. Again, likely to be appealed where? To the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the appeals court that supervises and oversees us here in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. But as of today, again, Judge McGlynn using that Bruin case from our United States Supreme Court to say that you can't ban assault weapons in America. Stunning, stunning coming out of that district court judge in Illinois. We are always so delighted to take your callers at 855-752-4842, your calls, your inquiries, and that includes you, Joe, from Madison. Appreciate your calling in this segment of the Maggie Dawn Show.
Yeah, John, I'd be interested in your reaction to this idea, which is going back to the idea of immigration. It's considered this ginormous problem, which is true, and the legislation that was put together and Trump said, ban it, you know, get rid of it. I'll deal with this stuff when I get in, so that a chance for a legal way of solving this left. But there already exists a legal way, and I'd be curious to your reaction to this. Back in, I think it was 86, Reagan came up with a law that said employers who knowingly hire employees, immigrants are subject to criminal penalties, civil and criminal penalties.
Right.
So the civil penalty was $3,000 and the criminal was 6 months in jail. 12 people this last year got this charge. Can you talk when you get back about why it would be that this side of the equation is not enforced when there already exists legislation to do it?
Outstanding comment, outstanding inquiry, Joe. So appreciate it. And when our program, our broadcast continues at the top of the next hour, I'm going to take that on. So appreciate that insight, because it does go to the rule of law and justice in America, which is all a part of our discussion here in the Maggie Dawn Show. Stay with us for answers to Joe's question and other issues here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.